1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1, go.
Go.
Did you need me on that too? Oh, I'm sorry. I just ruined the whole podcast.
Yeah, no, we did.
This is fine. No.
That was right.
It will work all the same.
I wasn't sure if it was just you and Jeremy. I started, I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay. All right, sorry. Cool. Welcome us.
From late June to early August, we took a 14,000-mile cross-country road trip to get away from the world.
It brought us to 20 national parks, 33 states, 46 cities, and 43 national monuments, forests, memorials, grasslands, and recreation areas.
So in each episode, we'll outline one of our stops, talk about the history of the place, our impressions, and a piece of dark history tea associated with it.
It's gonna be dramatic, scandalous, dare I say captivatingly funny, and hopefully it inspires your next trip in the United States.
This is Road Boys with Jeremy
and Jacob. Welcome to the season finale
of
Road Boys.
Road Boys.
Wow. Can you believe we made it a full season?
I don't know. It took some determination, some grit.
It took all the hard work.
It took blood, sweat, and tears. I bled profusely on multiple
occasions. Yeah, especially blood. Like, that's the big one there.
That's the one they don't talk about it that much that needs to be talked about more, is the blood.
You don't realize, putting up the microphone, it's very prone for blood injuries.
We get cut so many times doing this. I don't think people understand well enough.
Right. It's you know, we really put in a lot of work to make this happen.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us through this whole season. If you've been a longtime listener, if you're a newcomer, welcome to the show. We're talking about a road trip we took all of the summer of 2020, where we went to 20 national parks and all around the country, basically, to all these amazing places.
It's a whirlwind.
Before we start, I do want to mention our giveaway. We're going to be continuously posting about that this week. And with the rules to enter, that'll be on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Road Boys Podcast. You're entering to win a National Parks calendar for 2021, some exclusive Road Boys stickers, which look fantastic, Jeremy.
Oh, I know. I've seen some insider pictures of the prototypes.
Yeah.
And they exist. I'm not saying that they don't exist. They do exist. They are physically in existence right now.
Oh, absolutely. They're in existence. And also a very special other prize, which you have to stay tuned for, because that will be announced, Jeremy, at the end of this episode.
Yeah. Keep you hooked in. Keep you hooked in.
Yes. So that's all very exciting. But I know I don't want to waste any time this week because, Jeremy, is a huge show. Jeff Kirkjian is here today to speak with us.
Yes. I am so excited for Jeff. It's so great to have him on today. So,
yes, a close friend of ours, yes. Jeff Kirkjian, is here. He is the host of Jeff and Amy in the Morning on 102.7 The Coyote in Las Vegas, the biggest morning show out there. So it's very exciting to have him on the show today.
Very, very exciting. I got to say, when we were thinking about having him on, I just kept looking forward to this, and I think it's going to be fantastic.
Now, if that didn't clue you into what this episode is about, we took a trip from Area 51 down to the Sin City. We went to Las Vegas.
It was fantastic. I had such a great time. It was quite a relief to really re-enter civilization after, I don't know, the last week, which may have been one of our creepiest, most out there stops of the trip.
Yes, and now for the last time this season, Jeremy, would you call it the real deal?
Okay, I'm going to try and roll my R's. This is the season finale. I got to. Yes, I would call it the real deal. I can't. This is what I was scared of doing the entire season, Jacob.
We tried, and we'll get there eventually. Look out for season two with that. But we are in Las Vegas, so Jeremy, I understand you've prepared a story for us about Las Vegas. Let's hear it.
Oh yeah, I've concocted one. No, it's nonfiction though. I've done it through research. I made up.
So you've completely made it up, and it's nonfiction.
If I did, it'd be a pretty good feat to have made something like this up. So it's an exciting story. I think I ought to get into it right now.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so you know we all know Las Vegas. We all know what it's famous for. And considering the city's well-known history, you're probably gonna roll your eyes at me for this one. But we're gonna go back 10,000 years,
girl,
for the last time this season.
Bitch, what?
Don't worry, this is gonna last a second. 10,000 years, when members of the Paiute tribe inhabited the area, at least up until the year 700 Common Era. So we're already getting past the 10,000 years. I just wanted to say that humans lived there for a long time, not just people with casinos and money. It was a place before all that.
I disagree with that assessment. Okay.
Well, that's all I'll go into regarding the Native American presence in the area, because this is a town whose story has been shaped by the desires, the follies, greed, what have you, of white men.
Mm-hmm. Straight white men. How dare you not make that distinction, because this is a disgusting city of those people.
Yes, straight white men. I guess we got to do our, fabled tale one last time with a place like this. We've done it all throughout the season where straight white men come in and they really fuck things up. So here we go.
There you go.
We land first in the year of 1821.
I thought we were going to start with the casino stuff.
Oh, it quickly develops into that. You'll see. This place has a very long history of that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yes. Well, first, Spanish explorer and pioneer Rafael Rivera was the first known European to scout the area in an attempt to open up a trade route between New Mexico and California. It would be known later known as the Old Spanish Trail. So that's what white people were first doing there when they set eyes upon this land.
Okay. They're heading towards California.
Heading towards California. Now, the next part of the story makes me question if Rivera actually ended up in the Las Vegas region, because he named Las Vegas, it's Spanish for the meadows, and it was named after spring-watered grasses in the area. And I don't know, I don't think that we saw anything like that. I thought I just saw desert and dryness.
No, yeah, it was definitely very desertous. Can I say that? Is it, or it's like mountainous?
Mountainous, no, it's rugged, it's arid.
Rugged.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a geologist. I don't know.
No.
Well, I just didn't think spring-watered meadows of grass. When you think of Las Vegas, it's not there. I just, like,
no,
itch-ware.
Not at all.
But, we're going to keep going. And in 1848, the area's ownership shifted from Spanish, of course, to American rule. And after some Mormons tried to unsuccessfully settle in the area, we come upon a very quiet time from the region where it was very lightly inhabited. Not much going on there. Lasted from like 1855 to 1905. Now, this is where you're asking about the casinos, right?
You wanna know. Absolutely.
You want to know. So what happened in 1905? The San Pedro, Los Angeles.
The World's Fair.
Yeah, well, yeah. A lot of things were happening in 1905, and one of them was the World's Fair, but also I think the development of how we know Las Vegas as it is today. So, of course, what needs to happen in a lot of Western towns for there to be a population boom? Some would say we've experienced it in our history's introspections ourselves. It's the arrival of railroads.
We had a lot of that when we were in like Santa Fe and all that stuff. Colorado. Wow, that's a throwback.
Alamosa, big one. Denver, huge one. So, yes, the Las Vegas was successfully linked to the Pacific and a lot of the other railroad networks in the United States in that year. So now you have a link to the world, and people start coming in. So although Nevada outlawed gambling in 1910, that hobby by then had already become very popular in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. It was very important to the city's economy. People just coming in, getting off the train, wanting to go to a gambling hall. You know, nothing really else out there to except, you know, spend your money.
Sure.
Exactly. So despite anti-gaming law in 1910, as I mentioned, gambling rings continued to operate in underground speakeasies and illicit casinos. So there you go. You start getting organized crime.
Ooh, get me some organized crime, girl. I'm all here for it.
So we're laying the groundworks. We're laying the groundworks for what we would eventually see in the year 2020. But again, we're in the early 1900s. But I will again do another jump. We're now in the year 1931. What happened in 1931? Well, Nevada's state legislature legalized gambling once more. They're like, no, this is making too much money for us to not profit off of it.
Mm-hmm.
But by then, it didn't really matter all that much. I mean, it was good that it was legalized so people would, you know, stop getting in trouble, I guess, for this sort of thing. But organized crime had already taken big root in the city. In regards to gambling, casinos, and that whole entertainment, nightlife, what have you. So
I wonder what it would be like to be an organized crime.
I can't tell you too much about it, but it's not.
No, I'm not allowed to say anything, but
it's not as all. You know, it's not the most. Watch The Sopranos. You watch The Sopranos.
The Sopranos is ridiculous organized crime. I'm talking about like real organized crime.
It's probably a lot of paperwork. You know, it's
that's
really
what I assume.
Boring. It's probably
what I want to show about. I want to show about like the paperwork and like them filing different things and like actually cooking the books and whatnot. That's what I want.
I want someone like a bookie, a show about a bookie. He's writing, he's putting in a bunch of like tax things on some form of paper, and then the show ends because he just randomly gets shot, and that's the only piece of action in the entire show.
There you go. That's the show I want.
That's probably what it's really like. So this is a city where it's full of people like that. There's organized crime already taken root in the city. But by 1931, another big development happened. That was when the government started basically contracting people to start work on the Hoover Dam.
We went there.
We did go there, and because of that, there was just a huge population explosion from 5,000 to 25,000. Doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a ton of people during that time to come into the region.
It's 20,000 people.
20,000 people.
It's a small town.
It's becoming a fledgling city, some would say.
Ooh, a fledgling.
A fledgling. A fledgling. A fledges. Mm-hmm. So with this influx of people into the region, Nevada's state legislature, of course, as I mentioned, legalized gambling. And because of that, you start getting these massive profits for local businesses. They start making a lot of money. And just like that, a mixture of business leaders and mob bosses worked basically in tandem to build a series of hotels and casinos off of Fremont Street, which is at the time the town's sole paved road.
Basically, well, there you go. So that's where we're getting the strip.
That's where we're getting the strip. And I'll get to that in just a second. It is basically the old Las Vegas Strip. It isn't what it is. It isn't where it is today. So,
yeah, they're building the road. See, it's going to have all the casinos, see?
Exactly. This is what people would say when they walk down the street.
Yeah, right after they finish smoking their Camel cigarettes.
Mmm. Go on. Get you some.
Go on. Get you some.
So that was something that was obviously being uttered as people walked down the streets. And by 1936, the Hoover Dam helped with that whole aesthetic of the place, because when it started to work, all the electricity there started powering these really flashy hydroelectricity powered signs, which began to line Fremont Street. It started to be known as Glitter Gulch because of all the electric signs.
I love that word, gulch.
gulch.
It's a gulch.
That's where they just where they dumped all the electricity.
Glitter gulch.
Glitter gulch. So by 1940s and the 1950s, those decades, they saw the boom of the Las Vegas Strip itself.
The boom!
The boom, exactly. So Fremont Street wasn't technically where the Las Vegas Strip is. It was part of, actually, U.S. Route 91. So it became part of the city's jurisdiction, actually, way after the city was founded. It wasn't part of Las Vegas. It just was sort of sucked into Las Vegas. And there we go.
Gotcha.
So we have at that time a lot of casinos popping up. The Flamingo, you have a lot of people in there sort of running the place, such as the Mob. Wait.
Do you mean the Flamingo, home of RuPaul's Drag Race Live?
Yes, the Flamingo, home of RuPaul's Drag Race Live. You have some gang members working the books, some mob hits. And by the 60s, you have a lot of corporate conglomerates starting to buy up hotels.
Gotcha.
You have very big people with a lot of money investing in the casinos. And that's basically how we get to the Las Vegas that we know today, where it's just a huge entertainment place of just
a huge entertainment place for straight white men.
For straight white men, except until RuPaul's Drag Race came to town and set up shop.
That
leads us to 2020, basically, because that's
2021. That's where we are now.
Well, yes, yes. It's when the show closed in 2020. this is the most – Las Vegas is the second most visited the second most visited city in the U.S. It obviously kind of shows you the type of taste American travelers have when it comes to their travels, that this is the second most visited place in the U.S. for them. And last – in 2019 – for reference, the city saw 42.52 million visitors, and it's only one spot down from New York. So there you go.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that's Las Vegas.
Yeah, it is Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's a place. I thought there was some entertainment in walking around and seeing the buildings. I thought that was cool.
I thought that was really cool. I mean,
it was really hot.
Oh, well, I mean, that was like we went during the hottest time of the year.
Yeah, it was 115 degrees, I believe, the day we
115,
were there.
That's right.
We stayed in the Luxor.
We did stay in the Luxor. It was cool. I was actually a little bit upset that we didn't get a slanted room, you know, and our wall was just straight up. That was what I was sort of hoping for, but I enjoyed it. I just remember though how hot it was. The night was so hot. We walked the strip one night, and you could feel the heat coming off of the road.
We were
just balls of sweat at that point.
The other big thing we did was go to the Neon Museum while we were there. The Neon Museum, of course, the home of all the old neon signs in Las Vegas.
That is correct. I thought that I mentioned Glitter Gulch in the history, and I think that's where a lot of them actually ended up in the end, was this museum. I think people don't realize that they retire these things. And it's just a place to go see them. I thought it was fantastic.
Exactly. So we went to the Neon Museum, and we met up with our good friend from the old days, Mr. Jeff Kirkchin, who's now the host of Jeff and Amy in the Morning on 102.7 The Coyote. How do you make a coyote noise?
I think they actually sound atrocious. And if I were to imitate it, it would probably
go for it.
Literally, that is the sound I've heard them make before. They're like closely related to foxes. I'd like to go into the etymology of it all, but you know,
what does we'll the see. Coyote say?
Not what the song says. They literally screech, I think.
Yes. All right. Well, without further ado, we had a chance to sit down and talk to our good friend Jeff Kirkchin about living in Las Vegas, what that's like, and let's get into it. Welcome to Jeff Kirkchin. Thank you so much for being here today on the show.
Well, thank you guys, and congratulations on the success of this podcast. I mean, Who would have thunk? Honestly, you guys are so talented. I'm so glad this is working out for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so
much. It's been a wonderful ride. And we're so grateful to have you here on our season finale. This is the last episode of the season.
Culmination. The culmination. It ends with Las Vegas and you.
I'm the big twist at the end of the big season.
You're the twist. You're the twist.
Oh, I hope I don't disappoint.
Yeah, so obviously last week we were in Area 51 on the show, and now we are here in Las Vegas talking to Jeff, who we met up with while we were there. First of all, Jeff, what is living in Las Vegas like? I know you've been there for a couple years now, right?
Yeah, I've lived here since March of 2018.
Wow, okay. Mm-hmm. So in that time, what has been something like surprising to you, because everyone knows like Sin City, blah blah blah, the Strip, all that stuff. What's been surprising to you about living in Las Vegas?
Well, I'd first say that how I grew up on the East Coast, trees everywhere, water, none of that exists mm-hmm. out here. I mean, we are in a valley, in a desert, and it is every bit of that. And but that was shocking. And even looking out the window of my house right now, I've got this beautiful view of these gorgeous mountains, and that's something I didn't grow up with either. So it's a totally different, just from the sheer aspect of the terrain, it's totally different. But when it comes to, I grew up right outside DC in Maryland, and there's so much history there. There's so much that happened, you know, the founding of our country in that area. But sure. out here,
yes.
there's so much room to expand. There's so much to do and so much to see. And it baffles me because this is a very transient city. A lot of people like myself didn't grow up here. My fiance grew up here, but she's a dime a dozen. You don't see a lot of people who are born and raised in Las Vegas because the city 25, 30, 40 years ago was a whole lot smaller than it is today. And
right.
just for everybody listening, no, I do not live in a hotel or a casino. That's the first question everybody always assumes. So living out here is great. It's affordable. It's beautiful out here. I absolutely love it. We don't get any snow. And after going to Syracuse, I'm definitely blessed to not have any snow, let me tell you. It's beautiful out here.
Well, that's great. I mean, first of all, I want to say a few things in remarks to that. Congratulations on the engagement. That is fantastic news.
Thank you, Jacob. Remind me, when in real time were you guys in Vegas? I'm trying to pinpoint. I can't remember exactly when.
I think it was July 6th. Or July
6th. That sounds about right. Yeah. So we were building the house we now live in.
Yes.
Ironically, I'd actually just gone ring shopping. Probably a week, end of June, I had just gotten the ring, or at least like bought it, and then they had to make it really small because my fiance has very small fingers. And so, yeah, like a lot has changed. Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate that. A lot moving in my life right here. We, you know, moved into the house in October, got engaged mid-October, and everything. Now we're planning a wedding. Oh my gosh. That's exhausting. Oh.
Yeah, how's the new house been?
The new house is spectacular. I'll tell you guys, being a homeowner is the coolest, most stressful, but coolest thing in the world. But everything you do in your house, you're like, well, this is like my house. Like, I am like contributing to my house that I'm paying for. And one day when I stop owing the bank money in like 500 years, right. it will truly be mine, and I'll be able to sell it and get the fruits of my labor. So I've put up, you know, I put a door in the side of our garage, right, to go to the side of the yard. And that was like this big project. And it was so much fun, though. And it's like stuff like this has been, you know, being a homeowner is such a blessing to call space my own. And especially being in radio, I lived in Syracuse. I did radio there. I lived in Cleveland. I did radio there. Now I live in Las Vegas. To finally kind of settle and feel like I have a place to call home of my own instead of just hemorrhaging money to rent, it feels really great to be a homeowner.
Well, that's fantastic. Congratulations. And now I want to ask a little bit about your experience. Did you go to any shows before COVID?
Oh, yeah.
Did you go to anything good?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your favorite?
Oh, that's tough. I'm really, really obsessed with Cirque du Soleil because listen, like in my little world as a music radio host and a little bit of my own music experience being a singer and I play the piano, I can go up there and I can appreciate when I see, oh God, let's see, somebody I saw, Lady Gaga, right? I can go up and I can be like, she is an incredible dancer, she's an incredible singer, a great performer. But in my tiny little level, I kind of know what that is. Like, I kind of get it. But when somebody goes up there and balances 40 bowls on their head and spins them around while on a unicycle, I'm like, that is so beyond my comprehension that I can't even fathom that being possible. Or some of these strong men or these male-female duos who do these amazing acrobatics. I'm like, this is just unbelievable. So I would say Cirque du Soleil at the Bellagio is absolutely fantastic. It's amazing. It's amazing. Highly recommend. The Michael Jackson Cirque du Soleil 1, I believe it's what it's called, over at Mandalay Bay. Fantastic. Saw it New Year's actually last year with my parents in town. And, you know, they grew up in that era where Michael Jackson's music was everything. And so to take them and to let them kind of reminisce. And, of course, it's Cirque du Soleil. So the visuals are incredible. It's been – I've seen some great shows. I recommend that everybody listening, when things are safe to come back, you come and support local because that's what we are. I look at it as local performers. Isn't that crazy to think? It's like just like how you would go to the local theater or the local movie theater or the local bowling alley or whatever. I consider going, spending my money to go see a Cirque du Soleil show that just opened up as supporting locals, because people come here and they're just like me. They own a house, they rent a place, whatever. They listen to the radio every morning. So if I can support them and they can support local radio, that's awesome. That's locals supporting locals.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's crazy in the sense of like, you have the big local performance scene, but your local performers are Cirque du Soleil. They're Britney Spears. Right. They're Jennifer Hudson. Right. Like,
and a lot of them stick around, you know, and fall in love with this city. And that's the coolest part. And being it's just for a sheer perspective, let's just say, Las Vegas isn't much bigger than a Baltimore or a Cleveland or everything. But being the entertainment capital of the world, we get such beautiful recognition for bringing amazing performers in from all across the world to be a part of our city. And that's what I think draws me to it. And, you know, in my radio career, I think everybody says, oh, you want to be in the top five market. You want to be in New York, LA, Chicago, Dallas, you know, Washington, DC, whatever. But for me, being able to do radio in a live and local market like Las Vegas, that's the entertainment capital of the world. No better place to entertain people than the entertainment capital of the world.
Yeah.
Oh, and on that, so you think the future's bright? You think the city's going to bounce back once this is all crazy, all the craziness is over?
Jeremy, I hope and I pray that not just this city, but so many cities can bounce back. But looking at Las Vegas specifically, I mean, we're no longer, in my opinion, the sin city that people always say. You know, yes, there are some things that you can do here that are fun and hangover movie-esque, but the performances, the culture, the sheer thought that these artists will come here for months on end and host these amazing residencies, that's what Vegas is all about. And when they switch the slogan from "what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas" to "what happens in Vegas only happens in Vegas," that is so true, because we have things that nobody, you could be walking 10 feet and you see the most amazing Cirque du Soleil show, and 30 feet down the strip, you see Lady Gaga, and 100 feet down the strip, you see the most amazing magician you've ever seen. It's amazing, this city. And I hope, Jeremy, I'm no economist, I'm no expert on any of this, so take my word with a grain of salt, but I like to believe that people are willing and wanting to help these cities. And the first place people are going to go when things are safer is a Las Vegas, is LA, is New York, is Broadway, is all these places that deserve people to come back to. And I just hope that that's what it comes down to, is people coming back to town. I really hope.
Well, I got to say that, you know, even during this, all of this, when we visited, we had such a fantastic time. We, you know, we did a good bit. I mean, we'll tell a lot of people we've already probably gone through what we did. We walked the strip. We walked the we went in through a lot of the casinos, but I think one of the highlights, of course, was seeing you at the Neon Museum. So first I want to ask, how did you enjoy the Neon Museum? It was fantastic on our end.
Jeremy, the Neon Museum, I think that was my third time there, and what I love, and I recommend everybody to go to it in downtown Las Vegas. It's and Jacob, when you recommended that's what we would be doing, I was all for it. I mean, if you were telling me, hey, we want to come to Vegas and go to a strip club and you should come with, I'd say, I think I'll sit this one out. Let me know if you want to grab lunch before or after or whatever.
But that's, yeah, we're not the strip club people.
Yeah, no. I didn't think so. But the best part about it all is the fact that you guys got to learn about so much of the history of this great city. And that's what the Neon Museum is all about. And Jeremy, you're right. I mean, it was fantastic. And every time I go there, they've got a new neon. They've reorganized things. They've got new deals for locals. And I think it's important to know about the city that you're living in, because as I said before, it's a very transient city. A lot of people did not grow up here. And a lot of people don't realize the history of the city. And it's not just, oh, look at that. That's a pink neon sign. That's a blue neon sign. Like, we went on a tour, and that was awesome.
Right.
You could ask all the questions in the world, and as a local, I was asking questions, and you guys were asking questions as well as visitors. I think that was a high recommendation for all of your listeners, is when you do come to Vegas, check out the casinos, check out the hotels. I got about 100 restaurants you should go to, right. But go to the Neon Museum. Go to these places where you can learn. You've got to check out the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas as well. Absolutely love it. A great part of history. These hidden gems in Las Vegas are what make the city great.
Yeah. I think that's doing something like that. It was certainly a great opportunity for the both of us, because that's sort of why we're doing the podcast. Every single place we go to, you know, we'd leave having had a great time, but we wouldn't have known too much about of what we had just seen. So you go to a national park, you see it for what it is. It's beautiful. It has this to offer. But in the end, what did we know? And that's sort of why we've been doing the podcast. So it was fantastic, you know, of course, to see you. But then when we were in Las Vegas, to kind of go through and see the history of the city like that, it's not necessarily something we got to do, every stop.
Well, I don't want to speak to you two as preteen boys, but me, some of the stuff you guys would do, museums and tours and reading plaques when you're going by, that would be like the most boring family vacation in the world when I was 11. But now as adults, we can learn and appreciate so much more about what we're taking in. And look what it's brought you. It's brought you this amazing experience between two friends that now people who can't leave their homes, who don't have time to travel or just can't travel because of COVID, can listen to your podcast and now feel like they were there. And that is what I think is really special about what you guys are doing. And I honestly can't thank you enough for having me on, because like, you guys are letting people into your lives so they can feel like they've traveled too.
Yes. And in the spirit of, you know, learning new things and putting everything together, one final recommendation I have for you. So we've been watching a lot of RuPaul's Drag Race Vegas review. I need to live vicariously through you as you go see RuPaul's Drag Race live when it returns.
That's the plan. That is one of those shows. And I love it. I love these shows that come to town, because you literally have anything and everything. And if you're a fan of the show, I will go and I'll come back on the podcast to tell you all about it. And because it's these kind of shows that make Vegas unlike any other city. That's not parking up in Philadelphia. I'll tell you that much. That show is not coming in Philly, even though I love Philly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here, Jeff. Make sure you tune in and listen to him weekdays on 102.7 The Coyote, Vegas, right? Mm-hmm. And what time is that show, Jeff?
I'm 5 to 10 a.m., Jeff and Amy in the morning. We have our own podcast as well, Jeff and Amy On Demand. And we have an app, so you can listen wherever and whenever you want to hear some great country music and hopefully some entertaining stories about me and Amy. So,
yeah, there you go. You're also on iHeartRadio.
Mm-hmm.
So fantastic. Thank you so much for being here, Jeff Kirkchin. It was a pleasure.
Cheers.
Oh, wasn't Jeff such a joy?
He was a delight. I'd love to have him back. Oh, my God. Anytime he likes. come back on. We love him.
Thank you, Jeff, so much for coming on. Well, now it's time for our dark history, the last one of the season. Jeremy, what have you cooked up? I can only imagine Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah, I've cooked up something good. Well, Las Vegas. Well, in my mind, I think I find it fitting that we end the season with a dark history, the likes of the one I found this week. So, as you might have realized if you've been listening the entire season, there's been a common theme present, and that is that everywhere we've went, Native American populations have been consistently just shat upon by of course, straight white men, as we mentioned earlier in the episode.
Absolutely.
And this week, I think it's time we're talking about some gonna talk about some retribution. You know, some retribution. And so this week I did not find like a casino heist to do. I did not find like a mob hit. I know that might be what you were thinking. I found instead the story of Keho, the renegade Native American. He is also known as a Nevada legend, part of some folklore.
Boom, boom, boom. Now let me hear you say Keho.
Hey-ho.
Keho.
Keho. So this is about one man. So as I mentioned, let's go back to 1880. This is a long time ago. We're not talking about Las Vegas as we know it today.
Yeah.
We're going back to the years where not much is going on there. 1880 is the approximated year of Keho's birth. Although the identity of his parents are just shrouded in mystery, it is safe to assume his mother, named Kokopa, died shortly
after
Kokopa. I mean, I bet that's better. That's the better way to pronounce it. Kokopa died shortly after his birth. The background of Keho's father is a bit more ambiguous. Now, theories assume he was either a Paiute brave, which meant that he came from a neighboring rival tribe to his mother's, or he was a white soldier from Fort Mojave. In either case, it all meant the same thing, basically. It meant that Keho would be considered an outcast, someone of mixed blood. So not looking good for him on the outset. So add this to the fact that Keho was born with a club foot, and you can safely assume that he was just basically set up for a lifetime of misery. He was deformed. He was going to be an outcast anyway. This makes him even more of an outcast.
Great.
Yeah, it's around one of these. It's like, you know, we're way back in time. People are just so not understanding.
So what did Keho do?
So at an early age, he moved to a reservation in Las Vegas. He worked as a ranch laborer. He's gathered some wood. He, you know, in a mining camp nearby. He was just doing odd jobs here and there. That's on his resume. Sure.
Why not?
Exactly. But as time went by, Keho was prone to mood swings, and he was very quick-tempered. He probably sorely needed to see a psychiatrist, but where on earth was he going to have access to any type of help like that? I don't think it really even existed.
No.
But for him especially, it didn't exist. Nowhere to be found. Around the late 1890s, Keho started to have a bit of trouble with the law, and that is when there were rumors floating around regarding his involvement in the death of another Native American. So he's sort of starting out his life of violent crime.
Oh no!
Yeah,
poor Keho.
I feel this is a misunderstood figure, but he does some really terrible things. So let's get into it.
Okay.
His life of crime didn't really kick off until November of 1910, when he reportedly beat another Native American man to death. His name was Harry Bismarck. They started fighting. It was a brawl. He beat him to death. There you go.
Lovely.
So in his attempt to escape from the killing, murder of that man, Keho murdered two Paiute Native Americans and stole their horses. On the same day. This happened on the same day.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. So now the body count is three.
Why doesn't he have a movie?
I don't know. He's a Nevada legend, and yet I don't think not many people know about him outside of this region.
All right. We're educating the public.
We are educating the public once more. So this happened on the same day. He kills three people, but he also realized same day again he needed supplies to aid his escape, and he made a very quick pick stop in Las Vegas at a general goods store to do so. Now, when he was confronted with the store's shopkeeper, he was asked how he intended to pay for all the items that he was definitely stealing. He wasn't going to pay for any of them. He was running into the store and grabbing stuff. So when he was confronted by the shopkeeper, Keiko saw him, and then he broke both of the guy's arms and fractured his skull with a pick handle.
Oh my God.
Now
that's horrible.
Now he wasn't done though. Now I think we're past this day of killing. But he fled southward. He's still on the run, and he's going to El Dorado Canyon, which is south of Las Vegas, where he would eventually take shelter. And in the meantime, a search posse has already formed to find him, and word got out that Keiko beat another man to death during this on his escape southward with a piece of timber. This is a fourth killing.
Keiko's got a lot of anger.
I think he has a lot to talk about, a lot of pent up stuff going on inside him right now.
Yeah.
This is an interesting case. He beat him with a piece of timber. I think if there's anything you could say to describe this fourth murder is that it's like, I guess wood themed. It's a wood themed murder. So this time Keiko murdered a woodcutter named, get this, J.M. Woodworth.
You're lying.
I'm not. I'm so
there was a woodcutter named J.M. Woodworth.
And why? And here's another question. Why would Keiko kill him? What was the reason? What do you think was the reason?
Something over wood.
Yeah, so he scammed Keiko into cutting timber for trees. He scammed him into cutting timber basically for free. He was going to get paid. He didn't pay him. Killed him.
Well, bitch better have my money. Like,
yes, exactly. So by the time the search posse made it to El Dorado Canyon, Keiko's work there was done. And after the killing of Woodworth, all the posse found in Keiko's wake was, get this, yes, another body. We're on body number 5.
Oh my God.
It was the body of a watchman named L.W. Doc Gilbert, who was shot in the back. His special deputy badge was apparently stolen. That's how they thought. They really thought that, Keiko leaves his mark by stealing things from people after.
This is insane.
Yes. So we are on the heels of a fifth murder now, and he killed a man of the law. So things are ramping up.
Wow.
So from El Dorado Canyon, the search posse attempted to track Keiko further down the Colorado River, but to no avail. And given Keiko's club foot, the search posse found clues in the form of distinct footprints along the trail. It's like, this is how we know it's him. He has a club foot. It's a weird looking footprint. So they searched 200 miles for Keiko downriver. And they went home empty-handed, and they gave up on the search. So he is just a free man. He's roaming around somewhere in the wilderness.
Keiko's just vibing after just killing, like, five people.
Exactly. Five people.
Wow.
And in the immediate months and even years following Keiko's disappearance, his notoriety and legend grew in the southern Nevada region, of course, for, Las Vegas, of course, is included in that. So just to give you like an idea, people thought like if their cattle went missing, it was probably Keiko. If they heard of a disappearance or a theft or a murder that wasn't solved, they just said, oh, it was probably Keiko. It was probably
him. Became a legend.
Yes. He became a wives' tale. He became basically a boogeyman of sorts. People used to scare their children into behaving by saying Keiko could come get you.
Wow.
This is something that was going on in that region of Nevada. Now, in 1913, Keiko seemed to reappear after a local newspaper attributed the death of an 100-year-old blind Native American named Canyon Charlie to Keiko. I love that name.
Canyon Charlie.
Just this old man, this 100-year-old dude just chilling out there. He was murdered.
Oh, that's terrible.
It's awful. But although many assume Keiko would kill for anything, even just a scrap of food. This is how people started to view him. Many were unsure of Keiko's involvement here, considering the two of them were just known to be very good friends. So,
Interesting.
Exactly. Nevertheless, Keiko was back in the spotlight. And then not long after that, two bodies of miners working at the nearby Jenny Springs were found, both shot in the back, the provisions stolen, and Keiko was immediately named suspect number one.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So whether or not he killed Canyon Charlie, it really wasn't up for discussion. People are thinking that he's now on another murder spree, which he could have been. We don't know.
He could have been.
Could have been. So public outcry was growing and growing, and a reward for his capture grew to $2,000.
Which is like a lot of money. $600,000.
It's like your lifetime's savings right there.
Yeah.
But despite the hysteria, Cahoe remained a free man. He remained on the run, and he did so. He remained free for 6 years. This is for six more years. We're gonna jump to 1919. After years of circulated rumors as to his whereabouts and crimes, Cahoe was once again suspected of murder after the body of two prospectors were found dead just upstream from El Dorado Canyon, his old stomping grounds.
No way.
Yes. So I'm almost losing count of his murder. I think we're around seven or eight right now. Seven or eight. And so their bodies were found lying near these curious looking footprints, and immediately they're like, it's Cahoe. It's the guy. It's our guy. Then he was accused of another murder that same week in January. The wife, Maud Douglas, the wife of an El Dorado Canyon miner, was found shot to death in her canyon. And although her son claimed that her father killed his mother, law enforcement didn't care. They were like, it's Cahoe. They don't care. They're thinking it's this native guy that's on the run.
Like, that's unbelievable.
And I don't know. I'd probably be inclined to believe the son, but you know, they're thinking it's him. It's got to be him. They villainized him to this point, but he definitely has killed a lot of people. He's definitely killed a lot of people regardless.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're getting pretty close to the end of his story though. So immediately, the reward for Cahoe's capture increased another $1,000 to $3,000, and a new all-star law enforcement posse led by Deputy Frank Waite was formed. This deputy, by the way, basically made it his life's work to find him and bring him to justice.
To find Cahoe.
It's like basically, if this is the movie, he'd be played by, like, I don't know, Timothy Oliphant or something like
gotcha.
That. You know,
gotcha.
Season four vibes. for 2 months, through rain and snow, mountains, deserts, all types of climates, the party searched vigorously for Cahoe, but again, it didn't work. They didn't find him. He's on the run. So Cahoe remained a wanted fugitive for not just a matter of weeks, months, or years for that matter after this, but decades. Yes, they didn't find him for decades.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get to the year 1930, where this is the last year anyone thought they saw the man. A policeman thought he spotted him strutting down Fremont Street in downtown Las Vegas. So, like, he literally thought he saw him strutting down the strip one day. In town, out in the town, having a good time. But by the time reinforcements arrived to make an arrest, he was nowhere to be found. So this is it. Finally, in 1940, three prospectors found human remains in a cave in the side of Black Canyon just outside of Las Vegas. Curiously, the remains were mummified, which is interesting.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't know how that would have been the case. Did he have followers? I have no clue. But they were mummified, and they lay alongside a very telling artifact. And that artifact, this goes back to earlier in the story.
The foot?
No. Well, oh. Well, I mean that they did find his skeletal foot. But the artifact was the special deputy badge number 896, which is the first badge he stole off of that watchman that he killed way back in like 1910 or 1911.
I just got chills.
I know. They found it. I guess he held on to it. Maybe he kept, you know, mementos from his murders. The posse finally got their man, and I guess they could say the day was saved, but he was long dead. He was long dead when they found him.
Really?
Yes. I mean, it was a completely, if you can look at the picture, his skeletal remains completely have been, you know, rotted out. It's just a skeleton. just a skeleton by that time.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a whole lot of, after his death, the story didn't really end there. There's a whole bunch of things that happened with his body. His body was put on display multiple times in celebration that they caught the guy. It was eventually transferred to the Museum of Natural History at the University of Nevada. And his body was laid to rest. It was given a proper funeral. But in conclusion, Cahoe remains a Nevada legend to this day. In his lifetime, he was essentially public enemy number one. He is considered to be Nevada's first mass murderer, by the way, which is an interesting.
Wow.
First mass murderer.
He was number one.
He was number one. And although there are doubts regarding his involvement in some of the murders of which he's accused, it's safe to assume, and I didn't get to all the murders in this when I give you this number, it's safe to assume he remains credited with the deaths of 23 people.
Oh, my God.
With 23 people.
He's just a full-on serial killer.
Yeah, I know. And he's not – he wasn't, you know, sneaky about it. He really killed people by shooting them, and stealing their stuff. Sometimes in the midst of other people, and still was able to escape.
Like, that is crazy.
Crazy. Awful guy. But also, I do think that it sort of shows that, you know, people like this, they back then, he didn't have access to help. And I think this is someone who clearly needed help. Just goes to show what that could probably do for you if you have access to it. And I wouldn't say a misunderstood figure, but
wow. That's a crazy story that I can't believe I haven't heard.
I know it sort of passes the threshold, along the lines of like, you know, how long ago something has occurred to know about it. It's just one guy in Nevada, but I don't know. Back then you could do stuff like this, get away with it, and people wouldn't be that shocked that you did.
Okay, ho.
Okay, ho.
Oh, man, that was a great dark history, Jeremy.
Has a lot of twists and a lot of turns. I know.
I know. That was a really kooky one. But now it's time for our fan question of the week. And Jeremy, I pulled out some stops here for us this week.
Oh, what did you do? What did you do?
I have combed our inboxes, and I noticed there was one name in particular that comes up a bit more than others, and I reached out to this person, and ladies and gentlemen, I don't even want to go waste any more time about this. We have super fan of the podcast, Jeremy Campbell, here with us today. Jeremy, hello.
Hello, Road Boys, Jacob and Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's an honor, Jeremy. It's good to meet another Jeremy with a great presence on this show.
Oh, same to you. Do people have the same name? It's a great honor to share it.
Jeremy Campbell, thank you so much for being here on the show to ask us a live fan question.
Of course. It's my honor and pleasure. My fan question for you guys is a question and an impression, because you guys are good at both. So,
Oh, so much.
Yeah, little twists in there for that. But let's start with, I'll say both, but my question is, what do you believe the cultural impact of the Harry Potter series is, and just your general thoughts about it?
Interesting.
And I like that one.
The second part is, based on all the characters you know, because there's a lot of quirky ones, I want you guys to do your best Harry Potter character impressions for us all.
I've been dying to be asked this question ever since the transphobic J.K. Rowling, came out with her stupid-ass statement like 6 months ago. But I don't know. Jeremy, what do you think about Harry Potter?
Well, I got to say that when I was very young, elementary school age, way back in the long time ago. I don't know. I'm not a big reader, and she got me reading at like that elementary school age, which I'm pretty sure my parents to this day are shocked about still, because after that was the anomaly, and that was it. That was it. So I think culturally, wait, Jeremy, let me get this straight. You're asking the cultural impact?
Yeah, cultural impact of the books, movies, okay. Its impact on people.
Yes, so yep. I know that there are some really good statistics, and I could have come to them with you, but I can't throw numbers off the top of my head. But, you know, statistics that say children that are, like, around the age I was, it increased their literacy rates all around the world because of those books. That's a huge thing to begin with. Otherwise, here's my hot take. They shouldn't be considered pieces of literary like mastery in my mind.
Whoa.
They shouldn't be taught in classrooms. And they should be, of course, you know, I encourage people to read them. I don't think that you take any of those books and take them into an English class. That's my take.
Okay, wait, that's crazy because I grew up on those books. I read them multiple times.
Yeah.
I saw most of the movies in theaters. I think I saw from the third one or fourth one on in theaters, which was a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved the books. I thought they were so influential. They were the most sold book series since the fucking, what do you call it, that fictional, the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
really?
but, you know, the movies, some of them are good, some of them weren't. So I don't know. I think Harry Potter has a lasting effect to it, except obviously the creator is an unfortunate human being.
Well, yeah, as we found out this past year.
Well, I'll swing it back. Yes. I want to swing it back to Jeremy. What do you think about your own question?
Ooh, that's very kind of you to ask, Jeremy.
I gotta bring it up.
Yeah, so the reason I asked this question is that I'm starting to read through the books again, and it just made me like think about that, like, wow, like the Harry Potter book franchise is the only successful movie franchise, and it generated a bunch of spin-offs and you know, like theme parks at Universal, I think. There's people making butter beer at stores. Yeah. And even though the main series has been concluded, for about like a decade, like the fact that it's still a cultural presence is pretty amazing. And I don't think a lot of book series could say the same. And I was a little hesitant to ask this too because J.K. Rowling did say some kind of, you know, uncomfortable things. So yeah, that kind of detracts some of the clout from the Harry Potter series, if you want to say that. But I don't think there's many other book series that can, like, you know, have the same level of influence. So I just wanted to see what you guys think, because you guys seem to be pretty culturally educated.
Well, you know, we're people of class, a certain status.
Mm-hmm. We're up on the ladder there, but
yes. But in terms of impressions, now I'm so glad you asked about this for Harry Potter, because I've been told I do a mean Hagrid. But it's only one word, so I can give it to you.
Alrighty.
Okay.
Harry? That was it. That was
five stars.
That was it.
Okay. Mine. So I haven't given much work to it. You know, I can do like an English accent, just like anybody, any old guy can do. But I don't know. I want to give what you may want to hear. I'm going to try to do Dobby. I'm going to try and do Dobby.
Oh, good.
I'm going to do Dobby, and it's going to be Dobby, like, say, like, he is a little bit more subservient. He's a bit more subservient, and he's a bit more American. He's also has some Southern charm. That's my Dobby.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Harry. Dobby can get that right for you right now.
Mm. Oh, he's got some Southern belle.
Yeah.
Some Southern belle.
I'm dying. I'm dying. Anyway, that's mine. That's my Dobby.
That's great. That's great. And so then much. And then I can do a little bit of Severus Snape I could throw in there.
Oh, yeah. I'd like
Alan Rickman.
I'd like to try some Snape, too.
Here we go for it. Turn to page 394.
That was good.
You Thank have you. Your mother's eyes. Yeah, you know. Any other good like distinct I mean, there's Maggie Smith who just played herself.
Oh,
I mean,
oh. Imagine if you sweetened the libation with the citrus. Could you imagine such a thing? Professor McGonagall realness.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
we love Minerva.
Minerva, of course.
Well, thank you so much for that question, Jeremy. That was amazing.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much for being on the show, too. We're so excited to have you here on our season finale, because that bridges us right into our giveaway contest. First of all, for appearing on our show, Jeremy, you are going to get an exclusive Road Boys sticker. Some exclusive merch coming to you straight from the Road Boys. So thank you so much. You stay on the line. We're going to get that detail for you. And also to announce that the winner of our giveaway, in addition to receiving a 2021 National Parks calendar and Road Boys stickers, will also come onto the show just like Jeremy and ask a fan question.
This is like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. You get to be invited in.
You're going to be on the show with us. It's going to be amazing. So make sure you're looking out on our social media for the ways to enter the contest. I believe we're doing it as you follow the page, you like the post, you comment on the post, tag two people, and say two places you want to travel, because hopefully we'll be getting to those places. So that's how you're going to enter. You can do it on our Twitter, our Facebook, or our Instagram at Road Boys Podcast to enter our exclusive giveaway for fans. And we're going to announce a winner in next week, I believe.
Yes, next week. Next week. Got to get those entries in, everybody.
Yes. Yeah, get them in. So that brings us, Jeremy, to the end of season one of the show. Can you believe it?
Yes. I mean, not yes. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I'm agreeing with you that we are ending the season. this podcast has been such a joy. It sort of came out into existence in the middle of nowhere, and I've loved every second of it. What can I say? What else can I say, Jacob?
You can't say anything else, but it has been a fantastic ride so far. And I'm also excited to announce post-season one, we're going to have some special mini-sodes out for you.
Some to tide you over. I know everyone wants them to tide them over.
Yes. Now, I believe we're going to call this Winter Weenies. Those episodes will be hitting you sometime in the near future.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And, you know, who knows what we'll talk about? Who knows? We're so much more than the road trip, even though that was, you know, a defining moment in our lives. We're so much more, and we have so much to say.
Much like Lupita Nyong'o, Onions, and Stockard Channing, we have many layers as people beyond the road trip. So make sure you're looking out for those. Keep up with our social media. Enter that giveaway. And on behalf of both of us, I just want to say thank you for joining us on the ride this season. It's been amazing. It's been incredible. And I can't wait, Jeremy, for season two.
I can't wait. That'll be the day. That'll be the day.
It will be the day. We don't have a release date yet for you. But again, if you're keeping up with us on social media, you will know when we're back for season two. You will know.
You will know. So yes, keep track of our socials. We'll be posting updates as to our new mini-sodes coming out, some recaps as to where we've been, and maybe at some point very soon where we're going in season two. You better believe it.
It's going to be amazing. So any final comments, questions, concerns, death threats, anything for season one?
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't think I have. I mean, I have like 15 backloaded death threats.
Right.
But otherwise, I'm good. I'm tied it over until our next episode, whenever that may be.
All righty. Well, there you have it. Thank you to Jeff Kirkchin. Thank you to Jeremy Campbell. And thank you for joining us here on Road Boys Season 1.
Season 1.
Bye.
Bye.
Road Boys, starring Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro as themselves. Produced by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. Directed by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. And created by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. Special thanks to Vlad Glashenko for recording the intro and outro music royalty-free. And Tina Perkins, that's me, for recording promotional content. To learn more, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Road Boys Podcast.